This talk is about explanation of the weather, trying to explain the weather, not trying to predict it. And some people think they are already very clear why we're seeing the weather we're seeing. So the Mail Online, for example, says firmly that climate change is a great green con and that all these theories about why the weather, the world is warming up completely last decade, so to speak. Bloomberg Businessweek, in contrast, firmly blamed Hurricane Sandy, that's the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy there in New York, on global warming. They were very clear about it. Anybody who didn't agree with them was stupid. So I guess that probably makes me stupid, because I'm not sure, certainly about Hurricane Sandy. So we're going to get on to events like Hurricane Sandy as we progress through the lecture. But I'm going to start off with more about climate and about why we think climate change is happening. And apologies for this, because you've come for it to hear a lecture about the weather, but unless you get the sort of the background on why we think what we think about global climate, then you can't really make sense of what we're saying about the weather. I've got a selfish agenda here as well, so I should declare straight away. I'm responsible in the current IPCC assessment cycle, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. There's hundreds of authors involved. I'm the one who's tasked with coming up with how we explain to the general public and to worse, to politicians, how we decide how much warming is due to human influence and how much is due to other factors. And so my job is not to give the answer, but to explain how we get to the answer we get to. And so this is what I've been scratching my head over quite a bit for the past few months, and I'm trying out the explanation on you. So, you are the guinea pigs. And so as we go through, I really appreciate, I'm totally lost now. You know, if you want to put your hand up and say, that didn't make sense, that's actually really useful for me, because part of my main job at the moment is trying to get this explanation right. So this is talking about the question of how we reach these statements like most of the warming over the past 50 years is due to the anthropogenic rise in greenhouse gas levels, due to the increase in greenhouse gases caused by human activity. And the starting point for this is this kind of figure, which I'm sure is very familiar to you. The coloured dots are observations of global temperature from 1860 to 2010. The red line, which you can see going through the middle there, is a simple average of the latest generation of climate models, simulations of the response to human influences. So that's a combination of rising greenhouse gases and other forms of pollution in the atmosphere. And then the black line is, again, the same models simulating from the past how the climate would have responded to things like solar variations and volcanic eruptions. So the most striking thing you can see, obviously, on the black line are the sort of sharp dips in temperature you get following a major volcanic eruption, the most recent one of these being Mount Pinatubo in 1992. So you can see that sharp dip there in the natural climate, the evolution of a natural climate. And so how do we take this kind of data and work out how much of the warming we see in those pink dots is attributable to human influence? So I'm going to take you through this process now, and I hope you'll stop me if I lose you, because in September, unfortunately not me, but somebody much more important in the IPCC will have to take the world's politicians through the same process, and they kind of have to understand, or at least I think they have to understand. There's an interesting problem in the IPCC. A lot of people sort of talk about the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, along the lines of, 700 scientists say this, so you better believe it. I really don't like that way of presenting any form of science, particularly climate science. You know, if you don't understand it, you don't have to believe it, okay? That's the point. I mean, science is about you understanding it, not just me saying, I'm a professor, take my word for it. So, Remember what we got here, the observed temperatures, coloured dots, and I've coloured them in according to the temperature, so red is warmer, blue is colder. And you've got the model simulated, anthropogenic, I'll use the word anthropogenic a lot, but it just means human-induced, if you try and remember that, is the red line, and then the warming and cooling due to the sun and volcanoes is the black line. So the first thing we do is take exactly the same data and we plot it not against time, but against the anthropogenic warming. Okay, so we've just, instead of putting time in the horizontal axis, I put the size of the anthropogenic warming. So notice where the red line reaches 0.2, I've got a 0.2 tick there. And where the red line reaches 0.4, that's the 0.4 tick. Okay, with me so far. I haven't changed anything. It's all the idea of this, you know, there's nothing up my sleeve. It's not statistical voodoo. Okay, so now all we do is we straighten out that. So notice now we've got a non-linear, it's a non-uniform horizontal axis. Okay, so I'm just going to straighten it out. Okay, the big danger with doing this kind of thing in Oxford is, of course, probably half a dozen people in the audience are probably professors of statistics, and so it's, but if you're not a professor of statistics, you're welcome to chip in. Okay. And even if you are, but perhaps reserve it till later. Okay, so here we are. So what I've done is I've just straightened out the axis, okay? And because I've straightened out the axis, the red line is now a straight line because I'm plotting human-induced warming against human-induced warming. Obviously, I've got a straight line. And the dots are sort of clustered up towards the beginning because, you know, the anthropogenic warming sort of started slow and then got fast. So that's why it's sort of been bunched up in this way. Okay, so having done this, I can then say, right, let's plot the natural warming against the anthropogenic warming, that's the black line there, the sort of slightly distorted version of the black line, and overlay the observations. So I'm just going to put the observations, the coloured dots, down on top of the natural curve. Here we are. So I haven't changed anything, I've just sort of moved the axes. All right? So you're still with me what I'm doing here. Okay? Imagine you're a sort of slightly bored politician. You know, would you still feel you were following at this point?
Not really.
Not really.
There's some point already getting a bit confused.
That last bit, but this step is so we got to here. Yeah, everybody's still there. You're just plotting everything against the human-induced warming, okay? And now maybe the next little step will help. I'm now going to put it all together on so colour is the observed warming. Y-axis is natural warming and cooling, and x-axis is human-induced warming. So the problem is you've got three things. This is the fundamental challenge we've got here. We've got nature playing a role, we've got humans playing a role, and we've got the thing, what actually happened. So you're sort of stuck with this thing being intrinsically three-dimensional. Fortunately, I've been playing around with that, okay? So here we are. I'm raising that third dimension. So the observed warming is not just colour, but it's how far we are off the screen. Okay, so we've got observations one way, human-induced warming the other way, and natural warming in the third direction. Okay, if I had three arms, I'd be able to give you three axes. All right. So do you sort of feel you understand what I'm doing here? I'm plotting the observations against human influences and natural influences. Now, having done that, I can turn it around. Okay, and you can see that the observations lie remarkably close to a plane. There you are, there's the plane. There's the best fit plane through the observations. And as the author of that blackboard said, everything has to be made as simple as possible, but not simpler. Okay? And this is kind of, I'm really trying to get across the fact that we don't, in order to explain what's happening, we have to account for the fact that nature is kicking the climate around, and human influences are kicking the climate around. And we have to assess both. We can't just look at our models and say, the models are warming up, therefore the world's warming up because of human influence. That's not the way we work. We don't rely on the models that way. What we do is we rely on fitting the models to the observations, explaining the observations with the patterns of change we expect coming out of the models. And this fitting process means that the amount of warming we blame on human influence is driven by what we actually observe in the real world. It's not something that comes out of the models alone. We use the models to tell us what to look for, but the amount of warming we blame on human influence is something we actually get from the data.
Can I just
Yes, please, because that's the point.
My problem with that is that you've used the model to define one of your axioms.
I've used the model to define one of the patterns I'm looking for, but not the size of the signal. Yeah? So that is crucial. Physics has to come into this. You can't work out causation from a single event. And, you know, we only have one observation of the world. I mean, the world itself. So you can't address the cause and effect problem by just looking at the data. You have to use some physics to work out what to look for. But all I've done is taken what the model predicted how the climate would evolve, but without assuming the model got the size of the signal right at all, in response to human influence, and also how the model predicted the world would evolve in response to natural factors, and I've used these two to try and explain what I'm seeing in the real world.
Right, but you're adjusting strategy, the formula that you used to distort the graph, that was based on the hockey stick.
It was based on the shape.
The shape of the hockey stick, not necessarily the magnitude.
Yes, that's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. So the shape is important.
You can see that it's qualitatively right.
Yeah, yeah. So the shape is crucially important. But again, we kind of know when the emissions happened. What we don't know is what the sensitivity of the climate is, and that's a whole other lecture. But we don't really know what the sensitivity of the climate is to those emissions. But we do know, you know, pretty much when we were burning, you know, fossil fuels and when we were pumping out other forms of pollution and so forth. So that shape is in many ways much better known than the magnitude of the response. Now, the magnitude of the response, if all you had was the models and you didn't have any observations to look at all, then you probably have to admit the magnitude of the response is still uncertain to probably a factor of 3, because we don't know what that sensitivity is. But because we've got data, then you can constrain it. You can use the data to constrain it. Yeah? The word constrain is... Okay, sorry, I'm probably shouldn't be using that word, but you know what I mean. I'm sort of limiting what's possible by what's consistent with the data. So having found this sort of best fit surface here, we can then actually use the gradient to say whether the models are overdoing or underdoing the warming in any particular direction. So do you see the gradient? If you look at the sort of slope of that surface on the back panel of that cube, you notice it's going up by 0.2 at about the same amount of time as it's going across by 0.2. In other words, it's sort of going up along a 1-1 line. That means the models have got the slope, the response to anthropogenic warming about right. So even though you didn't know that to start with, it could have been up by a factor of 2. In fact, this particular set of models gets the response about right. If you're a cynic, and I am a bit of a cynic about modelling, you could say, well, they have been working at this for a while. So it's not so surprising that they get the magnitude more or less right, because there is a certain evolutionary pressure on models that, you know, if they're really bad, they get checked out. But you shouldn't read too much into the fact that they get the magnitude about right, but it so happens they do. Yes?
Is this an average of models?
Yes. This is a straight... So, you know, keeping it, as I say, simple as possible, there's various other ways you could do it, but keeping it as simple as possible, this is just a straight average of the current generation of models. If you want the jargon, since I know where you come from, the jargon set, it's all archived down at the BADC in RAL, in the Rutherford Appleton Laboratory, and it's the so-called CMIP-5 suite of models.
Excellent. In terms of observations, or which kind of observations?
These are observations compiled. These are surface temperature observations compiled at the Hadley Centre. It's called the HADCRU T4 data set. It's one of three big data sets, three sort of major data sets, which can be about four now, actually, because the Berkeley surface temperature one is a fourth. They would all give a very similar picture. And these are compilations of meteorological observations on land, observations from ships of opportunity in the oceans. And a lot of the early ones are actually, it's quite an interesting detective process to try and work out sort of what temperatures were like. In fact, we owe a great deal, I'm sure there's a lot here actually in the exhibit, we owe a great deal to, in fact, the 19th century Royal Navy which faithfully recorded sea surface temperatures, even during battles. And you actually have people sort of recording, you know, they were dipping canvas buckets over the side and dipping a thermometer into it and checking. And you actually look at the records. In some cases, it was, you know, there were cannonballs coming in the side, and they were still measuring sea surface temperature, and which is phenomenal. And thanks to the sort of stoicism of those Victorian naval observers, we actually have a pretty good record back to the sort of second half of the 19th century.
So each point is
each point a year. It's a global average. Global average for the year. And of course, we can make this as complicated as you like. But I mean, in the sense that we could look at more than just the global average. We could look at, you know, and we do, in fact, of course, when we're trying to separate out the different factors. But again, I'm sort of looking here for a sort of haiku explanation, so to speak. Sort of, And it's still taken 15 minutes, so there is that, and I won't get that in September. yeah, politicians don't give you that long. We need to explain these things, because ultimately the conclusion you reach, like most of the warming over the past 50 years, is attributable to human influence. It has pretty big consequences. I mean, one of the crucial points, of course, is, you know, obviously there is still some, those little nails are not all, they've got some length. They're not all lying exactly on the plane. And nor would you expect them to be, because of course we know that there is natural variability, chaotic variability, weather variability, if you like, in the climate system, which we would never expect to be able to predict with the combination of greenhouse gases and anything else. I mean, this is intrinsically random variability in the system. And if we look at our climate models, that sort of haze of black lines there is the sort of size of variability you'd expect from natural fluctuations in the current generation of climate models. And the red line is what's left over after we've done this fitting process and worked out what we can explain with as a response to human and natural factors over the past century. And as you can see, the red line sort of stays within the black line. So in other words, what's left over is consistent with what we'd expect from internal variability. And although this gets a bit, sounds a bit nerdy, this is actually an absolutely crucial part of the whole process. Is you've got to be, as any statistician knows, you've got to convince yourself that your residuals are consistent with what you expected and that there isn't some big factor lying in there that's mysteriously unexplained. If we saw a sort of smooth oscillation in this residual, then that would be very suspicious. We'd say, okay, there's something clearly wrong with our model, but we don't. We just see noise, much as we would expect from the model simulated variability. Notice one thing about this, actually, that over the last 10 years of this period, we had you see a bit of a downturn. Going from a warm year in 1998, you see sort of that spike, 1998, and then we had a cold year, 2008. In fact, 2011 and 12 were also quite cold relative to similar to 2008. But as you can see, you know, we've seen periods like that in the past. You quite often get fluctuations. And of course, you do. You know, you have a noisy series, you're going to get periods where it fluctuates from one side to the other. And that's just the nature of random fluctuations. So we shouldn't read too much into these short-term variations. That's one very important thing to remember. I've already talked about how we can use the slope to indicate how much we're over or underestimating the different factors, the responses to anthropogenic and natural warming. And in fact, the bottom line is that the models get the anthropogenic warming about right, but they tend to over-respond to volcanoes. And we think we understand why. So those model-predicted huge spikes in response to volcanoes, those are bigger than what we see in the observations. And so, you know, the bottom line on this sort of analysis is that we can conclude that because the models are getting this anthropogenic warming trend about right, we can conclude that most of the warming we've seen over the past 50 years is due to human influence. So far, that's sort of looking back at the record and interpreting it using a combination of models and statistics. But one question you might, you know, worry about, you should still worry about a little bit, is, you know, is this just being wise after the event? Can we, you know, if we fiddle with our models long enough, you know, can fit anything, cynics would argue. So here's an example of how it may not be just being wise after the event. This is a study published, this study was published over 10 years ago now, but I'm bringing you up to date because we actually published an update on it only last week. And so this was a prediction of global temperatures using this process of how much of the warming is attributable to one factor versus another, and using those factors to extrapolate the observed temperatures into the future. Okay, so using a combination of models fitting to data to make a forecast of global temperature. So crucially here, the last data we used in this study was August 1996. In fact, the article itself, it took me quite a long time, mostly because we had our first kid in 1997, it took me quite a long time to get the article done, but it was submitted, crucially, if you blow it up, it was submitted in the last millennium, just, quite what I was doing, submitting a paper between Christmas and New Year. Anyway, my wife is very long-suffering. She wouldn't let me do it now. Fortunately, because it was submitted in the last millennium, we are now sort of quite a long time on. In fact, we're over 16 years on from the last piece of data we used. And of course, there were times when people took decadal climate forecasting seriously. This, of course, is Joseph making a 14-year climate forecast. So we've actually gone beyond 14 years. And Joseph got it right, we got it pretty much right as well. So this is actually what happened after the last data point used in the forecast. All the yellow dots are the new global temperatures coming in, and the two red, the two heavy red symbols are the decadal average temperatures. The first one, the immediate decade immediately after the end of the forecast, and the second one, the decade that's just concluded at the end of 2012. So as you can see here, forecast basically predicted that temperatures for the decade ending at the end of 2012 would be about a quarter of a degree warmer than the decade ending in August 1996, and we nailed it to within a couple of hundredths of a degree. So that's sort of suggests that it wasn't just a matter of overfitting, that we were explaining what happened before then, because if a model explains what's observed but also makes correct predictions about the future, that of course gives you greater confidence that you're on the right lines at least. Another interesting side comment on this is that a lot of people are very preoccupied at the moment with the idea that the warming has stopped. One of the things you realise looking back at these old forecasts is that actually it's not so much that the current temperatures are surprisingly cold, but that we had a period around the millennium where temperatures were actually quite a bit warmer than forecast. So we saw quite a very rapid warming in the late 90s, had a few years around the millennium where temperatures were quite warm, and now, as you can see, that little blow-up, which was kindly produced by The Guardian, actually, you can see in the little blow-up, we had a sort of fluctuation of temperatures away from the forecast line, and now it's sort of gone back, as you would expect it to do, to the forecast, because, you know, these fluctuations around a background trend, that's exactly what you'd expect. This forecast, incidentally, was cited in the IPCC third assessment, so that's back in 2001. It was part of the basis for the statement that the observed rate of warming between 0.1 and 0.2 degrees per decade, which is pretty much what you see there, that grey cone, would continue. So therefore, again, if you just want the numbers, if you expect between 0.1 and 0.2 degrees per decade, and then in the first decade you got 0.2, which is pretty much what we did get, then, you know, you wouldn't expect much warming in the following decade because it sort of bounced up and, you know, it's going to keep bouncing around like that. That's what global temperatures do. Okay, so we think we understand what's happening to global temperatures. In fact, we understand it. When I think back to when I started in this game, which was in the early 90s, the sort of general consensus, it's fair to say, the general consensus in Oxford at that time, when I was doing my PhD, was This sort of idea that the world would respond in such a predictable way to rising greenhouse gases was very naive, and that it's a chaotic system, and you know you wouldn't expect it just to carry on warming because it started doing so. But actually, it's turned out, it seems that the world on a very large scale is relatively simple. It does appear to be evolving more or less as expected. Not, I should stress, worse than expected. There were a lot of people, I don't think I was among them, a few years ago, who perhaps were looking at that sort of excursion above the background trend and getting excited that it was warming up far faster than expected. Most mainstream scientists were pretty cautious about that, and I think I wouldn't say it was worse than expected. I wouldn't say it was much better than expected. It's more or less pretty much what we expected back in the 90s. So we think we understand what's happening to global temperature. But it's this kind of thing that, of course, really matters if you live in Oxford. Those with sharp eyes, this is Vicarage Lane in 2003. Many of those here will no doubt remember those floods. These were the floods on the Abingdon Road. We've had floods, of course, in Oxford before. These were particularly damaging ones recently. And, of course, we've had more, particularly down the Botley Road, in the past few years. So how do we understand the relationship between that global temperature rise and events like Oxford weather? If there is a relationship at all, we shouldn't assume there's a relationship before we start. So the first thing to realise is that, you know, I've been talking about global temperatures, but we see a very similar picture in different regions. So these are the black lines here are observations, and the red bands are what you would expect from the combination of natural and human influence, and the blue bands are what you would expect from natural factors alone. And you'll notice that in most cases the observations have moved out of the range you'd expect from natural factors alone. So in most regions of the world, human influence on climate is clearly playing a role in the rising temperatures. But of course the pattern's not uniform. You can see here sort of brighter colours, redder colours show where we expect warming to be faster. So we expect more warming in the Arctic, where the sea ice is melting and you get a positive feedback going on. We also expect more warming over land. You'll notice there's actually a region of rather less warming than the rest of the world in the North Atlantic. And in fact, the UK is one of the regions which actually is sort of warming slowest, if you like. That's important because, of course, the way in which climate change impacts the UK is modulated by these large-scale patterns. And, of course, if we're concerned about flooding, it's not just temperatures we need to worry about, but it's precipitation. So this is the pattern of precipitation we expect. You don't need to absorb all the details. This is just to emphasise that if we're looking at precipitation, changing precipitation, there's much more structure to this. There's much more detail. It's much more varied from region to region. And when we zoom in on a particular event, like those floods that happened in autumn of 2000, we not only need to understand large-scale patterns of change in temperature and precipitation, but we have to understand how the atmospheric circulation is responding as well. Because what actually happened in the autumn of 2000 was the jet stream, which I hope most people here have heard of, is this band of high winds across the North Atlantic, which normally sits with a maximum over Newfoundland and over the north. That's the colours on this plot. So that's where the jet stream normally resides. And in autumn 2000, and again in all of these successive periods where we've had autumn and winter, very high rainfall seasons in the UK, we've seen a sort of average displacement of the jet stream out towards the UK. And what this means is that weather that sort of depressions and things that ought, as it were, to cross Scotland and dump all their rain on Scotland have been sort of diverted slightly southwards and have been dumping all their rain on southern England where it doesn't belong. Okay, and Scotland, I'm sure the Scots here, but Scotland's nice and hilly. You know, it can take a lot of rain because it runs off quite quickly. If you put the same amount of rain on southern England, it's all flat. You know what happens, the basins fill up and the ground saturates and we end up with soggy carpets in South Oxford. So this, even quite subtle, you'll notice the contours, they're not far off where the bright colours are. It's not a big displacement here. And the jet stream, of course, wobbles around from day to day by more than that amount. So it's quite a subtle effect you're looking for to explain something like a damaging event in UK weather. And this is the real challenge we have in making this link between global temperatures and large-scale climate change and UK weather. Here's something to remember, if you don't remember anything else from this talk. Climate's what you expect, weather is what you get. I understand this is due to Mark Twain originally. We can sort of turn this around now. Climate is what you affect, and weather is what gets you. Okay, so greenhouse gases, I'm just blaming you, of course, but you know, collectively, we are altering the climate. That's the sort of nub of the point of the first part of this talk. And yet it's weather events that actually do damage. So understanding this link between climate and weather is central to quantifying actually how much damage we're doing as a result of the rising greenhouse gases. Crucially, of course, Oxfordshire has flooded before. If you have time and inclination, and particularly in nice weather like this, go and explore around Shillingford, and you'll find there's an old house near the bridge in Shillingford, which has this cast iron plaque on the wall marking flood levels at different times. And there were some extraordinary floods. That's a bicycle, it's a bike lane, so you can get an idea, you know, that's probably about 6 foot, that post there. And I think it was 1803, the flood levels were well over people's heads. That's the sort of tick right at the top of this flood. And in 2003, where we had all that damage, that was where it was. Okay, so it was doing plenty of damage, even at that level, but you couldn't conclude just from seeing a flood like that, oh, this is climate change. Plenty of people did at the time, but you know, just because you see something like that, you can't actually immediately draw a causal explanation. And we do need to be careful about every time we see a weather event we don't like, blaming it on global warming. As Bloomberg Businessweek did at the beginning of this talk. In fact, there's a beautiful cartoon, I think in a South African newspaper, which a colleague picked up for me. So the guy on the left, if you can't read it at the back, he's saying, it's quite hot today, and the guy on the right is saying, yep, global warming. And then he says, ah, but they say it'll be unseasonably cold next week. Ah, that's because of the unpredictable weather patterns due to global warming. And then, of course, the guy on the right gets left gets cross. If it's hot, that's proof of global warming. If it's cold, that's proof of global warming too. Modern climatology is an easy science. So we need to be very careful of this tendency to blame everything on whatever the sort of explanation du jour is. And at the moment, it's undoubtedly, you know, a lot of people are very keen to blame any weather they see on human influence on climate. So, you know, since I was nearly flooded in 2003, a lot of my research group, not that we're entirely driven by parochial concerns in the university, of course, but we have been pretty obsessed, if you like, with this question of attribution and trying to answer the question, you know, can we quantify what the role of human influence on climate is on weather events like those flood events that occurred in the UK? And we didn't actually focus just on Oxford, it was more sort of UK-wide, this is a UK-wide study, and in fact we focused on 2000 because in the country as a whole, 2000 was a more damaging and more important event, even though it didn't do so much damage down the Abingdon Road. So this experiment was an exercise we did, in fact some of you in this room may have participated. What we needed to do was to try and quantify how the increase in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and the consequent global warming might have affected the chances of floods such as occurred in autumn 2000. How these external factors might have affected the odds of those floods occurring. We knew, because you can go and look at the plaque in Shillingford, that global warming couldn't be blamed entirely for those floods because there was a sense in which those floods could have happened anyway, because they did happen, floods like them, in the past. So what we were trying to do is work out how much the odds on the floods were being affected, the odds of floods of those of that magnitude were being affected by human influence on climate. So this is the point where I think we need to break out into a visual aid. So can I, we were talking earlier on, can I ask you to roll this dice, please, and call it out. Roll it on the floor and call it out. Yeah?
Six.
Okay. Nothing much about that. You want to roll it again?
Another six, but it hit the wire.
All right. Okay, we'll say that's a buy. Okay. Another six. Okay. So you're a very lucky man. But we could.
Well, you've got a loaded duck.
Yeah. Okay. Well, well, there you are. So yes, it is. Yeah. We could keep doing this, but it would get boring. Because it is it's a very heavily loaded dice. But you can buy them in the joke shop in the Turl, by the way. But it serves to make. You did it much better than I did when I was trying it out on Newsnight. There's a rather embarrassing clip on Newsnight, some people might have seen, where it refused to come up six. I'm like, come on, the damn thing. Anyway, apparently there's some magic in live television that things never work if they involve animals or children or loaded dice. Anyway, it did come up six more often than it should have done anyway. But the point here is that you roll a dice, you get a six, okay, and it's a loaded dice. Is it because of the loading? Well, in a sense it is, because obviously the loading made it much more likely you were to get a six. But you wouldn't say that but for the loading you wouldn't have got a six. All right? And that's the sense in which we have to understand the link between weather and climate. Okay? We are loading the weather dice in favour of certain events happening and against other events happening. It would have been very hard for you to roll a one with that dice, for example. And so some events are becoming more likely, others are becoming less likely, and crucially, you have to roll the dice a few times to realise. And that's important. Now, in this particular dice, you didn't have to roll it very often. In fact, I think you guessed after about two rolls, okay? Which is fair enough, but if it was a much more subtle loading, then you might have taken, 20 rolls to realise, oh, I'm getting, 10% too many sixes. And all that. And you could still sort of put it down to a fluke. And in fact, for a really subtle effect, such as we found to our cost, so to speak, the role of human influence on climate in the autumn 2000 floods, you might have to roll the dice literally tens of thousands of times in order to see the impact of human influence on climate coming through in the odds of those floods occurring. Now, we were unable to do that in Oxford with our own computing resources, so in fact, we did this by enlisting the help of the general public. And in fact, if any of the volunteers who helped here, and I know a couple of them are here in this room, my long-suffering father actually allowed us to test out the software on his home PC, and I think we broke it on several occasions. But eventually, by the time we released it to the main to the general public, it was pretty reliable, and it still is. And if you want to join in, Google Weather at Home or climateprediction.net, and you can be running your own climate model on your home PC within a few minutes, and contributing to this effort of basically rolling the weather dice many, many times to see how different factors are affecting the odds on different weather events. The kind of models we're running can be pretty realistic. I mean, this was the model we used for the autumn 2000 study. And if you compare weather in the observed climate on the top panel and the evolution of weather in one of the wetter members of our ensemble of runs of the climate model on the bottom panel, you can see that we're seeing the kind of events we saw in the autumn 2000 in this model simulated really quite realistically. We obviously don't see them at the same time because you wouldn't you can't predict the sequence of sixes, so to speak, in your rolls of the dice. But we are seeing that this model is capable of simulating the relevant meteorology for the autumn 2000 floods. And I'm going to give you a result. And so this is an unashamedly challenging plot, but, it's important. So bear with me, and I will explain to you what it's about. We wouldn't bother to show this to a politician. So what we have here is in blue what our models told us, and comparing them with observations, what we infer, the risk of a flood of a given magnitude was in the autumn 2000, so you have rarer events in the horizontal and worse events in the vertical. Okay, so you obviously the bigger the flood, the less frequently it happens. That's why the blue slopes up in that direction. All right. Now the green haze is what we think this risk return plot would have looked like in a hypothetical world without human influence. The world that might have been, if you like, if we hadn't raised greenhouse gas levels, which we can simulate in our models. Of course, we can't observe it directly in the real world because we only have one look at the real world. The real world, if you like, is just one of these points. And you can see there's many, many, many points on that, each of which is a one-year simulation of the weather performed with a fairly detailed weather model. Would have taken a couple of months on somebody's PC back in the years when we did this experiment. So you can see there's tens of thousands of runs required to do this kind of analysis, mainly because we're not seeing a very strong signal. You could put it that we're seeing a doubling of risk, which sounds fairly dramatic, but you can also see there's a lot of uncertainty in that world that might have been. And you can see that, the green band extends all the way up to the blue one. So it's possible that we haven't seen any increase in flood risk as a result of greenhouse gases. It's possible that we've seen more than a doubling. If we had to put a number on it, we'd say it was about a doubling was our best estimate. So that is some evidence that past greenhouse gas emissions have increased flood risk in the UK. But it's important to stress, it's a pretty hazy picture. And, sounds a little bit like British Rail now, it has to be the right kind of flood. And in a follow-up to this paper, Alison Kay and co-workers down at CH Wallingford used exactly the same data to look at a very different kind of flood. This study was looking at a flood that did happen in autumn 2000. And Alison and her colleagues asked the very intriguing question, how has human influence on climate affected the risk of a flood that didn't happen in the spring of 2001? And you may think, this sounds a little bit academic, but of course, if you're in an insurance company, floods that don't happen are just as important as the ones that do. So it is important to understand how different risks are changing, even though you may have only seen some of them actually happen. So this is a spring flood on the River Don. And you can see here, the green haze is mostly to the left of the blue, meaning that the human influence on climate has actually made the risk of a flood like this one on the River Don less likely. You may think, well, that's a bit strange. How can global warming, you're sort of accustomed to thinking of global warming making floods more likely, but not every kind of flood. This is a spring flood, which has happened in the UK, last happened extensively in 1947, where you have an accumulation of snow, yet rain on the snow, massive flooding, as all the snow melts suddenly and overwhelms the ability of the rivers to get rid of it. So spring floods have become less likely. Autumn floods have become more likely. And in fact, over the year as a whole, floods risk has gone up ever so slightly, but not as much as if you focus on one season or another. That, of course, introduces a really interesting conceptual problem. If that's the situation, and we're going to get onto this sort of whole question of liability towards the end of the talk. If an autumn flood happens and that kind of flood has been made more likely, but you can show that another kind of flood has been made less likely, does that mean you can't blame greenhouse gases, or you can blame greenhouse gases for the flood that happened? That's not really a scientific question. That's one for the lawyers, really. Interesting one. Another event, which I'll skate over quite quickly, just to show that we don't just do floods, we don't just focus on Oxford. We looked at the Russian heat wave, this extraordinary 12-degree temperature anomaly you can see there in central Russia in 2010. And again, the conclusion there was that the warming we've seen since the 1960s, at least, has increased the odds on a heat wave of that nature. In fact, from by and large, our conclusions for heat waves are rather, as you might imagine, are rather stronger than our conclusions can be for floods. But heat waves are not typically something we're very preoccupied by in Oxford, certainly not now. So I thought giving you a talk about heat wave risk We might be seen as a bit tasteless after the march we've had. Anyway, so the question, just however I can answer the question you're all, I hope you're all asking, was humanism's climate to blame for the wettest 9 months on record, which is April to December 2012? Those were that 9 month period in the Radcliffe Met Station was the wettest 9 months we've ever seen, according to Ian Ashbold, one of the observers there. And our preliminary answer, and I should stress this is preliminary because this is early days for this analysis, notice the paper on the autumn 2000 floods was published in 2011. That was pretty slow even for us, but I mean it does take time. And the reason for that was because the reason it took so long is we really weren't sure what the answer was, and we didn't want to come out and say yes, no, you know, without really trying to pin it down. So this is very preliminary, and so don't, if there's any journalists in the room, I'd rather this didn't get reported. As far as we can tell, the answer's no. Okay, so this is two distributions, bell curves of probability. I'm sorry it's not on the same format as the others, but the group only produced this plot last week. So Sarah Sparrow and others working here in Oxford have been doing exactly the same kind of thing, looking at the distribution and how the distribution's shifting. So this is a bell curve of probability. If you'd seen the red curve shifted to the right of the blue one, you'd be saying, ha, human influence on climate had increased the risk of these intense precipitation season, but you're not seeing that. As far as we can tell, so far, and this is very preliminary analysis, we have human influence on climate did not play a big role in those summer floods and the high summer precipitation we had last year. So this is what politicians are saying. Back in 2000, John Prescott was saying, you know, people know that something's wrong and climate change is affecting them. There is a, therefore, I would say it took us 10 years he came out pretty quick. It took us 10 years to scratch our heads and thinking about it. But we'd say, actually, you know, the idea that something's wrong and that climate change is affecting weather risk, I would say that's actually probably a reasonable thing to say. Others are saying stronger things. Here's a quote from Al Gore as recently as 2011. I'll draw your attention to the last sentence here. We're not only rolling 12s, we're rolling 13s and 14s, and soon we'll be rolling 15s and 16s. This is I much less comfortable with, this idea that we're seeing weather events that we simply would not have seen without human influence on climate, I think is very difficult to support with the science we have at the moment. So you have to be clear that, you know, the influence, say if you're blaming large-scale drivers of climate for the weather, it's not that we're seeing weather events that couldn't have happened if we hadn't interfered with the climate. You're seeing the dice being loaded in a particular direction. And for many events, like the spring floods on the River Don, if they had happened, that would be an event that had actually been made less likely by human influence. And other events, like the wet season we had last year, the wet summer, we would say it actually hasn't made any difference either way. So that's where we're at. But what I do want to try and convince you is that, so I'm afraid Al gets across. What I would like to try and convince you is there is a reasonable question here. That not just, that this is interesting, obviously I'd like to convince you this is interesting science, but there is an answer to this question. You know, when something happens, in principle, the scientific community should be able to answer your question about why it's happening. How much has human influence on climate contributed either for or against the risk of this event occurring? At the moment, we're not doing that. We hope, actually, and I'm agitating continuously, that this should ultimately become part of the job of the Met Office. That the Met Office should not only have its part of its brief predicting the weather, but it should also have, as part of its brief, explaining the weather. That whenever we get to the end of a season, the Met Office should be able to say, yeah, okay, we've just had a season, all these bad things happened, or good things happened, and this is how the odds of them happening were affected by human influence on climate. Or other things, like were affected by the volcano we had last year, or were affected by the current state of the sun. This is perfectly doable. All it requires is rolling that dice quite a few times. And unlike, of course, you rolling the dice, which didn't take a huge amount of effort, for the Met Office to do it, it involves running a massive supercomputer an awful lot of times, in order to do that. So it does take resources, but I think these are resources that would be very well spent. Because there are people who really matter, who think the answers to these questions are important. Here's one of them. David Grossman, writing crucially in the Columbia Journal of Environmental Law, i.e. not a scientific journal, that's why it's interesting, but he was writing about global warming and weather events being affected by global warming, and he was saying that plaintiffs, people who were affected by adverse weather, must show that the risk factor in question had increased the odds by around a factor of 2. Now, if you remember our autumn 2000 flood study, that was about the factor we were seeing. Of course, we had a lot of uncertainty in that. So I probably wouldn't want to stand up in a court to defend that as definitely more than a factor of 2. But there are other events, for example, the European heatwave of 2003, for which the evidence is stronger, and we probably would be able to defend the risk having been increased by at least a factor of 2 as a result of human influence on climate. And that, of course, is very interesting, because it opens the whole possibility of those responsible, those who profit by the processes causing global warming, being held liable for their consequences, which really turns the whole global warming discussion rather on its head. And that's actually where I'd hope the conversation will start here. By the way, as a little bit of an aside, if you think this sounds far-fetched, and it is a little far-fetched at the moment, I'm prepared to admit that, liability for CO2 emissions might be far-fetched, but what about if we actually start deliberately geoengineering the planet, deliberately seeding clouds, for example, or into the stratosphere to try and protect the Arctic from higher temperatures, which is actually being seriously discussed as an option. This is, if you like, so there's a plane busy creating clouds in the stratosphere, it sort of creates, if you like, an artificial volcano, which can, as you saw in those opening slides, have a substantial cooling effect on the planet. So if we set up a permanent artificial volcano, you have the ability to turn down the temperature. That would work, but there would be side effects. And a very interesting paper published only last week looks at coincidence of northern hemisphere volcanoes with the Sahel rainfall record. And intriguingly, in this paper, they showed that the very dramatic Sahel drought that occurred in the early 1980s, you remember Bob Geldof? So it was preceded, cause and effect you can't prove here because it's observations, but they also had some modelling studies to suggest this is cause and effect, was preceded by a northern hemisphere volcano, which of course is exactly what you would do if you wanted to keep the Arctic cool. You'd put up a sort of permanent northern hemisphere volcano. So if you did that, you might well get blamed for turning off Sahel rainfall. Well, more worryingly, even if you didn't turn off Sahel rainfall, you can bet your life you'll be blamed for absolutely anything that happens, whether it's too much or too little rainfall. If one country starts doing geoengineering, it will then immediately start being blamed for whatever weather happens, wherever it happens in the world. So, this whole question of liability is going to, it's going to bubble up in some form as the climate issue progresses. So, you may be asking yourself, who is to blame? Well, one of the easiest drivers, sorry about the size of the text here, but one of the easiest ways to sort of sum up relative contributions to climate change today is just by asking how much carbon has a particular country emitted since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And you'll notice we're normally accustomed to thinking of America and China as the sort of big polluters. But just to make you feel powerful, I just want to draw your attention to the fact that the sort of just after China on this plot is the little United Kingdom, okay, with a fairly small fraction of the world's population, because, of course, thanks to some of the ingenious inventions exhibited in this museum, we got burning early. We actually have a cumulative carbon injection into the atmosphere almost as large as China's, and per head of population, of course, we are in fact the world's largest polluter. So, be afraid if this liability thing ever starts to take off. I'm slightly worried about the time. I'll sort of progress through quickly to sort of where I think this might go. So this I finished the science, now you'll be happy to hear, and the rest of this is just a sort of rant about the political implications. The reason this matters is that when people talk about the climate issue, they typically forget some really basic big numbers. One of those big numbers is the $5 trillion a year we spend on fossil energy. Now that dwarfs anybody's estimate of what climate change is likely to cost, either adapting to or the consequences of climate change over the next 50 years. Okay? $1 in every 10 is spent on energy, most of that on fossil energy. So the sort of standard picture people have of climate policy is that somehow we're going to increase the zero amount we spend at the moment on emission taxes and permits, turn the world energy economy upside down, and somehow make all these impacts go away. I find that completely implausible. And it's not happening anyway, that you can see. So what's actually happening is, you know, we've got this sort of zero expenditure on taxes and permits. You could instead try and incorporate these near-term costs of climate change into the cost of energy, and the need for taxes and permits might just go away. Just another thing to think about. This may seem a rather odd example to give as an environmental good news story. So this, as I'm sure you can remember, those horrible pictures of oil gushing out onto the floor of the Gulf of Mexico a couple of years ago, and the shrimp fisherman in the middle losing his livelihood. But of course, the shrimp fisherman could have got a job helping with the cleanup. And crucially here, that cleanup, then the shrimp fisherman would have been both compensated for and paid for helping with the cleanup by BP. BP didn't bat an eyelid about the fact that, yep, you know, yes, they tried to get some other companies involved as well, but they certainly didn't say, you should blame all the people who use our petrol. I never heard that argument being put out. If you release fossil carbon onto the floor of the Gulf of Mexico, you're responsible. But if you release fossil carbon into the atmosphere, you're not. Why not? So if these greenhouse gas emissions are exacerbating those wildfires in Australia or this storm in Alaska, then perhaps there's a sense in which, you know, we should be making this connection and linking up the cost of dealing with the consequences of climate change to this massive industry that's primarily responsible. Of course, the challenge, this particular village in Alaska is interesting because they have been trying to take on big fossil fuel companies. They are still in the process, they keep losing, but they're still in the process of suing ExxonMobil for the costs of maintaining their sea defenses to protect them against Arctic storms, which they are claiming have been made worse because the sea ice is all melting during the storm season, and as a result, waves are coming in and crashing over their defences and smashing up the village. So far, they've been pretty unsuccessful, but it's interesting, the reason they've been unsuccessful has not been that anybody's really disputing the link between rising greenhouse gases and increased storm risk in the vicinity of Kivalina. It's been that US courts, in particular, have argued that the solution must rest in the hands of the legislative and executive branches of our government, not the federal common law. In other words, if I just translate that out of lawyer speak, relax, citizens, governments have it all under control. I find that a very worrying statement, particularly because I was recently at the UNFCCC meeting in Doha, where people were sitting around talking about climate change, and you really did not have the feeling at that meeting that governments have it under control. But perhaps things are changing. One of the things that happened in Doha was that for the first time, the issue of loss and damage was formally placed on the UNFCCC agenda. That's the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. So governments are starting to talk about who's responsible for the costs of adaptation and cleanup, if you like, to climate change. And this is going to raise some really interesting questions, which are not scientific questions, questions which you're as well qualified to ask as I am. You know, If you're living in Europe and you buy an emission permit for almost nothing, because they're very cheap at the moment, does that mean you're not liable for the consequences of your emissions? I don't know the answer to that question. Does that mean if the European Commission has made those permits ridiculously cheap by over-allocating, does that mean the European Commission is liable? I've asked them this question. They haven't answered it. They haven't even acknowledged the question exists. But it does exist. If people are handing out, arguably, the world's single largest authorizer of greenhouse gas emissions today is something that claims to be the good guy, the European Commission. What's their liability in all this? One crucial question, of course, if you sell fossil carbon to somebody who has no option but to use it and vent the CO2 into the atmosphere, are you liable for the consequences? That's important because, of course, nobody's going to chase all of us driving around in our cars. What the lawyers are going to want to find the big companies who sell us the fuel we put in those cars. So that principle of upstream liability, it's called, is absolutely critical for any credible liability regime to develop. Where could this lead? Well, you know, it could be a fundamentally different way of approaching the whole climate issue. You say instead of trying to get agreement on how much we should emit into the atmosphere, you just say, emit away, but you're responsible for the consequences. And eventually, as the suits come in and the bills come in for paying for the costs of climate change around the world, you know, companies would look at this and say, yeah, it'd be better just not to dump this in the atmosphere, wouldn't it? And avoid all these annoying lawsuits every time the weather gets nasty somewhere in some corner of the world. And there is an alternative. You know, we can use fossil carbon. They're building this now in Australia, the world's largest CCS plant, carbon capture and storage plant. We can use fossil carbon without venting the CO2 into the atmosphere. So, just to sort of give you a sort of challenging picture to remember, that was the charge that BP took for the Deepwater Horizon disaster. Okay? If BP was simply held liable for the climatic consequences of their products, that would be actually a much smaller charge, but growing. And eventually a company like BP might decide, yeah, okay, we'll take care of this. And then the whole problem of climate change would just go away. Wouldn't that be nice? Good point to go to questions.
Thank you.